What's happening, everybody? You're now tuning in to the Producer's Corner with Spud 2 Titan. Man, I have a hot show for you today. On the phone with me, I have a very gifted and talented music producer, songwriter, and musician who's produced everybody in the biggest names in the business, man. I remember we're talking about Earth, Wind & Fire, Patti LaBelle, and Miss Aretha Franklin. Please welcome and put your hands together for Mr. Wayne Vaughn. How's it going, Wayne?
How you doing, man?
Pretty good, Wayne. Man, it's just an honor for you to come on the show and chop it up with me, man. Man, I consider you as an industry veteran, man, for the artists and the work that you've done over the years, man. It's just phenomenal. You know, one of the songs that you produced and did, man, and wrote, I mean, it happened to be one of my favorite songs, Earth, Wind & Fire, Let's Groove Tonight, man. That was 8 weeks at number one on the charts, man. That's just phenomenal, man.
Wow. Give me the history, because I know none. I had just heard Rita. I had read in the Verdeen in Hollywood about 2 months ago, and he was talking about the end of the year. They do the countdown for the records, but I think they had the top 500 singles, and he said Let's Groove came in at number four. And I said, what?
Wow.
So I don't know these things, but then people come back to me and tell me what's going on. So I find it quite interesting at times.
Well, it's good music, man. I mean, like I say, something like a track like Let's Groove Tonight, man, it's a timeless hit, and it's always going to get played, and people still appreciate it, so it just goes to show you.
Now, beautiful, man.
Man, you know, you're such a diverse background as a musician, Wayne. I mean, how did you start out and, you know, merge into the music industry?
Well, basically, from a musician, playing flute in the third grade, then went from that to playing piano around 13. I got interested really when we had a talent show in the ninth grade, and that got me, you know, playing in front of an audience, and that really had me so I'm like, oh wow, this is fun. And then my dad, he was my greatest probably inspiration, and he would take me to clubs, and we would work clubs around 15 or 16 playing with setting in with Willie Bobo, and Willie was a bad Tim Bobby player, and then Eddie Cano was a really bad Latin pianist, and they would give me encouragement to keep going. And then from there, started really studying music, like music theory, when I was around 15, 16. And music theory is what got me into the world that I'm into now, which is if you can hear it, then you can play it, you know, and understand it. So music theory, probably my greatest thing that I could have done in the music business is learn that and get a little mastery of it. So I really went into the harmonic concept. So that's why I thought my tunes, you go back into some of them, they'll have different modulations that don't make sense, and then we'll get back to tonic in some kind of way. And when I could do a lot of rides with Maurice, he would really be... Yeah. Oh man, that's cool how you got that chord right there, man. We would have fun playing with the harmonics and stuff, but I didn't know at the time what it was training me for. But it really shot me off into the direction of composition. Which in the band that I would have, I would be the weakest player, but I could write the tunes. So I would always have the baddest musicians around me and have them realize my compositions, which was, you know, that was the most fun of all, man. You have something in your head, in a few hours you hear it play live, from thought to concept to actual. That was just always fun. So from that, it took me into the realm of continuing that through my college days up at UCLA. And I left out of there. One of my good friends was working with Quincy Jones, and he was saying, "Man, Brother Johnson needs a keyboard player. Something happened." I think Matt Adderley's son was playing boards, and something had happened to him. I think he was going to play with Luther Vandross. So I said, "Oh, okay." So Quincy heard a tape of me, and the tape was recorded at, I don't know, I think literally the slowest speed you can tape on a tape back in those days. I think it was 3.5 or something. And
okay.
A quarter, and Quincy had to listen to it at 7. He didn't have anything to go that slow. And he listened to the keyboard part that I was playing, double the speed, and said, "Oh yeah, he can play." So I went from UCLA on a Friday to the Brothers Johnson on Saturday, and I stayed with him 6 years, and ended up having my first song ever recorded on one of their albums called Bland. It was a platinum album. They had 4 platinums in a row, and Quincy produced the song, and I was just like, whoa, you know, that was like the most fun that I could ever have.
Actually, I'm a big fan of the song "Blam." Actually, man, I have all the Brothers Johnson albums. I'm a huge Brothers Johnson fan. So, man, just you know, knowing that you're playing behind these albums just amazes me.
Man, it's a trip. I haven't heard that song. I haven't heard that song in, wow,
man, is that
20 years or 25 years? I haven't even heard it.
Man, it was hot because it just came with a bass line. Dun, 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 dun. Man, I listen to it all the time.
Well, that was Louis Johnson came up with that bass line wanting to be jazzy, because when we would play and they would introduce the band, we would be playing on I think either "Get the Funk Out of My Face" or this tune "Right on Time." They would introduce the band. And when it came to my solo, and Lewis wanted to play jazz really bad, I would think, "Okay, Lewis, go into this walk right here, man. I'm in this solo." So when they would get into the groove of the song, everybody's funking and stuff, and then when they get to my solo, Lewis would start walking like Ron Carter or something. And I would just start, you know, playing some fast jazz lines, and he would get a kick out of it.
Man, that synth lead you used on there was amazing, though. It had just kind of like an envelope type of synth lead. It had a nice little pop at the effect of it. That's what really stood out to me for the solo.
Oh, well, see, now, we were out on the road, and I ran into the guy that did that solo, Larry Williams. I played the road, he had laid the track. That was my first time meeting Harvey Mason. Harvey was just like the premier baddest session jazz, I mean, now you're jazz, just wow, whatever he played, but he was the baddest drummer out there at the moment, at that time, and he was on the session, and I mean, we laid the track, and then we left town and was back on the road, like, in about 3 days. We did that session. We laid all of those tracks in one night, and that was when Harvey had introduced David Foster to Maurice. So David Foster was just getting in town from Canada. Harvey brought Seawind from Hawaii. That's how Jerry Hay and him came to meet everybody. And he brought David, who David was just about to go and record "After the Love Is Gone" and all that stuff. It hadn't even happened yet. And I'm in there just happy to be in the company and playing on my first major record. I'd already played out and did one record on a label called Black Jazz Records back then. That was just like in 75. It's a record somewhere floating around with a guy named Ron Jefferson. He was Les McCann's drummer over in Paris. He really liked Paris and was over there a lot. And I thought, okay, yeah, I'll get a jazz record. I just thought I'd never do another record or go on the road again. And who would have known, the next year, I'm out for 6 years straight But yeah, that was the beginning of David's career, and I had no idea. After David, I was the next in line to work with Maurice. I had no idea.
Wow.
How that stuff goes, and he was all excited. Yeah, we're going to work with Earth 25. And, you know, that's September came out, and After the Love is Gone came out. So you never know what you're going to do in this business, you know. So
it's truly amazing, man.
I tell cats, remember gravity. Just remember gravity. You don't get too high that you got to come back down, and you're going to run into a lot of the same cats you saw when you were growing up. So hopefully you were treating kindly. Man, don't burn the bridges as true as I can think of.
Man, definitely. Relationship building is key, man. Even on from a business side, just on a personal side, man. I mean, that's just nice to have in your life just to keep you balanced.
Yeah. And it will keep you balanced if you keep that concept and that focus, because it was always an old saying back in the day, don't read your press clippings. I think I took it to heart because I never read mine. So I don't even know. Sometimes I don't know things I should know, or that's probably one of my downfalls. I don't get into that stuff enough. Right. You know, the market. I've got a bunch of kids, and they all into it, and they're like, Daddy, come on, let's do this, let's do that. So they're pushing me more to do, to get back out there and start playing again. Matter of fact, that's what we just started doing now, just getting back playing. I resurrected some of my favorite guys I used to play with back in the day, and because we were all, in a sense, when we all got out of college, we were drafted into different bands. Like one of my boys, Gerald Brown, he left college, he was going to USC, I'm at UCLA, and then he leaves and go out with Freddie Hubbard, and he goes out with the Jackson 5 when they're still the Jackson 5. So Marvin Gaye, he was on some of that live stuff. And I mean, the other guys went out with Rufus, but then the other guys went out with Stevie Wonder, and then I had some boys to get out with the Commodores. And
wow.
Just, you know, the hottest bands that were out there at that time, they were all getting out there. And then what we would call the bands that we didn't consider was that hot, cats were going out with Johnny Guitar Watson and all this stuff, you know. So I'm like, guitar is cool, but y'all on the bus a lot. We flying, yeah.
Now, Wayne, you had opportunity, man, to play with a lot of vintage hardware synths, like the Mini Moogs, the Arves. I mean, what was your favorite back then, and what are you using now? Are you crossing over into, like, the virtual synths, or are you still using a lot of your hardware synths?
Actually, I'm into the virtual synths now. I had a Arp 2600, Arp Odyssey. When Oberheim came out, I had their four voice, which was really a bad underrated synthesizer. And you know, I never owned a Mini Moog out of all of those, because when I was going to buy a Mini Moog, a synthesizer came out called the Prophet 5.
Oh yeah.
And I had just bought a car, brand new car, for $4,200, and the Prophet came out, and it could hit five notes at once, which was unbelievable. And that synthesizer cost me $4,200. I still have it in a case somewhere in at my studio, because I can't get rid of it, because I spent too much money for it. Not even the fact that I'd want to get rid of it.
Right. No,
I can't get rid of it.
Man, I'm the same way. I mean, a lot of the synths, I have pretty much owned every synth that came out of market, man. I've owned them all. And I mean, now, because I've crossed over into the virtual world where I'm using everything on the virtual synth side, I mean, they're just sitting there collecting dust. You know, it's like, man, but I don't want to sell them. Just like, man, I invested like $6,500 in racks, and man, I can't just, you know, give them away. So,
no, you just can't give them away. And then one of my boys, I almost bought a mini movie, but not even to use it as it is. But one of my boys, pick all the brains out of it and make it into a rack. Because my problem with synths back in the day is that they had the plastic keys, and I hated plastic keys. I didn't like the light touch of organs. I like
you love the ivories.
yeah. I like weighted keys when I play. So when I think it was the T8 probably came out with one. It was a weighted keyboard. And boy, I went crazy over that. And I would have really kept focused on that kind of stuff. I would have bought one of those right when the market fell out.
Right.
That was one of the baddest synthesizers I've ever run into. Then I'm sure you remember when Rhodes made the Chroma and all that. That was probably one of the first synthesizers that utilized the sequencing that was just coming into play about that time. So if I had everything from the MSQ 700 on up.
Wow.
I would tell kids now, I say, we started sampling and sequencing. I remember my first compact portable computer I bought back in 84, 85, somewhere in there. 84, 85, I bought a compact when IBM PCs just coming out. I think that was, the hertz was so low. I think it was 177 or something like that.
Right.
I mean, it was program Roland made. Wow, can't remember the name of the program now, but it was like their first computer-based sequencer.
Sure.
And I would laugh. I said, man, we're going to be able to sequence the whole song at home, get it to the studio, and go out and get a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
And, boy, did all that stuff come to pass. And then we would have, like, the AMS that would sample at the time for 500 milliseconds.
Mm-hmm.
And it cost 10 grand.
Yeah.
And we were, like, so happy because that thing could replace drum, snare, kick, claps, stuff like that. So we would use it to, you know, re-record a snare drum if we wanted to replace the one that we had just recorded. And that was just an amazement. We had no idea that the kids would start sampling whole songs.
Yeah, it changed everything, man. When the Farlight and the Synclaver came out, I mean, then other knockoffs started coming off. Like, I owned the Emax, too. I had the very first Emax, too, when it came out, and I just kind of brushed into sampling. But, you know, I was never really looper because I play keyboards. I'm a keyboard player. But what I did like was be able to chop up drum samples and snares and kicks and really build my own library. That's what I started utilizing, you know, around 88, 89.
Exactly. That's when it really was coming into play, because you said a Fairlight. One of our boys had a Fairlight. You know, you had a Synclav or a Fairlight back then. That was like the thing. And then Stevie Wonder had this thing called the Diaxis. You remember that thing?
Yes.
It was like when I was the first 486 PC I ever seen. We were still on 286.
Mm-hmm.
And a 486 took it that the guy was showing me, well, look, man, I could pull this reverb out of here. And he went and got out the first virtual reverbs and stuff.
Right.
So then he made his own thing. And I had already bought the Ursa Major, but I was not going to spend no 10 grand for no digital reverb. All those Phil Collins records coming out with the reverse gate and all that stuff, you had to have it in your arsenal.
Right.
So I paid $2,500 for digital reverb that the same sound I can get in the greeting card at Target.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know,
those things are what, maybe 8-bit?
Oh my god,
yeah, it was really low.
and the thing about it is, I had a I had one I was going to tell you, something about the tech now. Oh, when we had those days, I bought 20 megabyte hard drive for $600.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I'm at the store the other day, and they had a 2 gigabyte stick for $9.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was crazy the way things have changed so much. I mean, it's cool in one aspect, and it for me, I think technology has, it kind of hinders a lot of younger musicians, in my opinion. I mean, because sometimes there's a lot of guys out there, I feel, that are taking shortcuts and really not learning the craft just because they have tools that will substitute you do it manually, you know what I mean? Whereas like you and I, we came up, man, even you before me, I mean, I started tracking around 89, 88, 90. I mean, because I was only 14 years old when I started tracking, man. But you know, just coming up from a different background to where things are now, where everything is just like virtual, it's available. I mean, you don't have to be a great keyboard player to put a beat together now, you know.
Oh, no, you don't have to. I mean, and that was, I purchased a Melodyne the other day, and that's like crazy. I'm like, oh my God, I have to really go and listen to records now, because you could go in a Miles record, take Miles off of a 2-track recording, and put yourself on top of it.
That's
and
I've right.
heard it, you know, so that's what that technology. So definitely I said, oh my God, kids are going to be using this.
What are you tracking on? I mean, are you using Pro Tools, or are you on Logic, or are you on PC?
Yeah, I'm in Logic. I have a Pro Tools, but I prefer Logic over Pro Tools, and I've been using that. I've been using Logic since it was PC based, because I was mainly a PC man, and I've always had a Mac, and I would go back and forth between Mac and PC, but when Apple bought Logic, then I used my PC version for maybe like 5 years afterwards, and then I wanted to upgrade, so I had to go buy a Mac. So primarily that's why I have a Mac, because I couldn't use it Logic on a PC anymore.
Right.
But I like Logic. I like the virtual synth in it and stuff. And now with this Logic 9, it was just a trip, because there was some things that I wanted to do that the program couldn't do. And if I wanted to do it, such as VSO a track, I had to put it in Time Machine and let it render a new file and blah, blah, blah. And by the time I do all that, I'm tired. So now you can just, you know, with a little turn of the virtual knob, now you can VSO a track in Logic with no problem at all.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah,
I use Logic too, man. I've been using a Logic Pro user for a minute, and you know, I can't preach enough about it, man. Pretty much every episode I get an opportunity just to talk about Logic, just because I just feel it's, for me personally, the way I track and the way I play and the way I produce is really an all-in-one box for me, for vocal editing, mixing, mastering, and especially for tracking my MIDI instruments and my virtual synths, and the quantizations just locked on solid, and the sound quality for the mix is just impeccable, you know.
I mean, it's all there, and I tell everybody, I mean, it's not the choice, it's the noise, and I can use just about anything to make it happen, but in terms of comfort and speed and just the way I do, like you say, it's all the virtual sense, and I'll have, you know, one master keyboard. I have I'm still using a KX88 over at my studio, weighted keyboard for my controller, and then over here at my house studio, I have a CME weighted keyboard. I put one of those rip-offs that they did of a Mini Moog, have all these fat analog synth sounds. I have that, and then with everything in Logic, then to just cover everything else that I would need, I have a Phantom and a Motif.
Yeah, oh yeah, got it. I got a Motif, got the Phantom, got the Triton, Planet Fed XP30, and all the virtual synths, pop, anything out there I got for virtual.
Yeah. I mean, you can't go wrong, and it works on so many different levels, I'm telling you. It has everything that I need within that level. And then, just like you said, so much you can do with editing and all that stuff until I really use that sparingly now, because it gets in the way, or it has me messing with the music too much. So when I'm laying tracks, especially vocals now, I have them sing it all the way down. I don't cut and paste the vocals. And I get one good hook, because I was listening to Skin Tight and Fire the other day, Ohio Players,
okay, yeah.
And you could hear the way they were singing at the beginning to the way they were singing at the end. And it's, the inflections were similar, but they put a little extra bane on it.
Right.
And that's what's missing with a lot of the music you hear today. You hear bar 3, and it's the same bar as bar 83.
Right, copy and pasting them courses.
Yeah. It's simplicity at its finest, but at the same time, you lose that intensity of a track growing.
You do, definitely.
Yeah, you wonder why it's flatlining on you when it gets to the end, because this drummer is a man in the box, and he's not hitting the drums a different way, because he's feeling more energy after laying a track for 4 or 5 minutes. You start doing little tricks. You start taking the snare drum and the hi-hat a little differently, and you don't really hear that music right now today.
You don't, because a lot of those drums are programmed, and as a live player and versus a trigger player, it's like you lose the dynamics, you know what I mean? Because...
Yeah.
Yeah, granted, the computer is going to really give you consistency and volume, and it's punching hard, but sometimes, depending on the expression of the song, you might want to play softer and harder at certain parts, and yeah, you could program it, but again, those dynamics are going to be lost a little bit to me.
The programming, it for me, since I can do it, I don't, because, I don't know, it's just something about, I get bored easily when it comes to doing this kind of stuff, and with the ability to do it, that's when sometimes you don't. I mean, it's just like, if I got a guy in here and I'll call drummers or bass players based on their personality and what they add to the track, it's just like cooking, you know?
Definitely.
And I get the freshest ingredients that I can, so the same with the players, and let them go, and I just sort of direct minimally and just go, okay, man, give me a beat, here's a tempo, I know I maybe have a click, and now you can make your own click, you've had a drummer play and then make a click from that. So it's all kind of ways to manipulate and have it sounding as live as possible. I always say with the computer, I can't throw the baby out with the bathwater, the baby's here now, so I just have to clean it up. It's used to my advantage, but not to my I don't know, man. It's just like, it can get very boring for me if I don't keep the live. So what I've done for this new studio I'm just completing right now, I've put a live drum set in.
Nice.
I already have my 6'8" Kawhi that I've had for years, and this is my first time ever using it on records.
Wow. 'Cause
my studio was 17 miles away, and I couldn't bring the analog over here. I have 24 track and the board and the whole thing, and I couldn't get the two things in one place. And now with the digital recordings, I can actually take the piano and come over here with the laptop, record it, take it back over to the studio, and I've got an acoustic bass and upright, and some other instruments, Chinese gong and a lot of percussionists. I've got cajones and a lot of noisemakers, because sometimes I don't even want live drums anymore. I mean, like drums as we know them, but I've been going over to Brazil a lot, and some of the percussion instruments that they use on a lot of their music, I want to take it and bring it to popular music, if you will, but add these different drum sounds that aren't the regular things that we usually do and build tracks off of that. And it still keeps the groove. You've seen some of these guys with these cajones now, man. It gives it a whole different flavor. And, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm a big fan of world instruments and ethnic instruments, man. There's a lot of nice, vast libraries out there. It's like, man, that's nice, especially on the lower end. And like you said, it's just not your average kick or bass drum. It's something totally different that we don't have over here, so.
Yeah, so that's what I've been, I mean, I'm experimenting with that kind of stuff now. So I've probably written more songs over the past 3 years than I have in a lot of years. And I've done something that I haven't done in a lot of years, which is usually when I write a song, I record it immediately. And then, of course, I have it stacked up in tape or CDs or whatever, and I forget all about it. But this past 3 years, since I haven't been recording of my own stuff, I take it and I can still play the songs now.
Sure.
So that has brought me into another thing. It's almost like back in the days of back in the 70s now with these. So now when I'm about to record these songs now, it's just a whole different attitude and feel, and from the when I started them to where they are now, and reworking. Then actually my daughters are like amazing lyricists now, and they've written some really serious lyrics over these songs. So
wow.
I can't wait now. I'm at my last phase. I'm buying a desk to hold my equipment. I have one, but I'm letting them have it over at their studio. And I just bought the biggest Mac Pro you can get, because this time around everything is going visual. Well, it's already visual, so
yeah.
I use the Final Pro, yeah.
You run an A-Core? Black A-Core?
Yeah. Is it A-Core? Yeah.
Okay. Yep. That's a beast.
Yeah, no, it's more than I needed. My guy was telling me, oh, well, you don't need one that big. I say, but.
Yes, you will. I mean, if you're running, you know, if you're doing any kind of video editing, or especially going.
That's the one.
Yeah.
That's the one. I'm doing video. And he said, oh, okay then. Well, you need it for video then. But he was trying to get me to buy the Mac, what is it? The one, it's gotten really, it's a lot better now. But the Mac, the one that comes with the monitor and it's everything. You just
iMac?
iMac, yeah.
Oh, I got you.
Yeah. Yeah, he was trying to get me to do that to save a couple of dollars, which I was all about saving the dollars. But I said, man.
But, you know, you'll cap out and you'll max out in the long run, Wayne. I mean, there is a difference between Macs and MacBook Pro and Mac Pro. It's because, I mean, even though they run those Intel processors, the Pro end is just going to give you that much more edge, especially when you start peeking out in video and transferring those files, get you a couple of RAID drives, max about 16 gigs of RAM, you'll be straight, no problem.
Yeah, so I'm going to max it out on the RAM. I think right now it's at 4 gigs. So that's the next thing I do, because now with all the boards and stuff, you know, I'm used to having TalkBack and all that stuff, and I go, oh, I don't even know what TalkBack is. Okay.
You know, the if you want to save a couple of bucks, Persona's makes a nice central monitoring station. It has a TalkBack in it. So if you just want
to run
it.
That's the one I just bought.
Nice.
That's the Persona's and got the TalkBack and the monitor thing. So I got that, and I went and got the Focusrite Sapphire.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Thing, and it gives you, because we used to use API boards over at Hollywood Sound back in the day, working with the Fire. That was one of the first boards I ever seen, and those, man, that EQ on that thing is just steel.
Yeah, that's a real beefy EQ.
Yeah, Yeah, so they have all of that built into this Focusrite thing.
Yeah, Focusrite really makes some good sound cards, man. Their pre's and they're pretty decent. I mean, if you're into the Avalons and a little bit warmer signal using two versus solid state, yeah, Focusrite's going to give you that deal.
Yeah, I have that and also the Fireface 800.
Ah, yeah, the RME.
yeah, those things are. That one is the one that I use. But as time and space will have it, it went out. So it's in Germany right now being repaired.
Wow.
The whole Logic board went out on it. So, you do have these situations with all this new technology and stuff. But I try to keep everything in the box now as much as possible. So with the Trilogy bass and the Ivory and all that stuff sort of built in, so when I'm on the go, I can have some of those things at my disposal. Now, with Logic having main stage now, you don't have to take a rack around anymore.
You can channel your VSTs right from Logic on main stage.
Yeah.
Play live now. That's just phenomenal, man. That's again, amazing technology. Playing, triggering all your VSTs on live, that's just... it's a producer's dreams. Like, you'll have those sounds in the studio, but a couple of years ago, bringing it on stage wasn't as stable as we would like it to have been. So, yeah,
exactly. And when it first came out, I was scared to use it. I said, "Oh man, I'm not taking that to live." This. And then I talked to George Duke one time. And he said, "Oh man, yeah, that's what I do. I take it down like that."
Right.
And so, dude, you kidding me? You're brave enough to do that? Oh, man, please. Come on.
Oh, man. Wayne, I had an opportunity to talk to Duke, man. And it was just amazing to talk to him because, he's just been like a distant musical mentor for me as a keyboard player. So, man, you guys are just like veterans, and I just take my hat to all you guys.
No, George Duke is in a class alone, because he was the reason why he was like one of the first keyboard players. He and Jan Hammer and those kind of guys playing synthesizers.
Yeah.
From piano. And George can play the synthesizer.
He's a monster, man.
It's like when you get on these different instruments, you approach them like you're on the same instrument. He was one of the first that I noticed to play synthesizers like a synthesizer and a piano like a piano.
Yes.
So he literally approached it totally different, and I forgot which tune this was, but you remember you used to have the octave key going on the I think he was playing Arp Odyssey or something, and he had to play this crazy lick fast as heck and switch the octave key and go back down an octave to continue the line.
It's got
to
be probably Achina's Arp by Frank Zappa. That he does that a lot.
Yes, it was that.
I'm a Duke fan.
Wait a minute. It was that. Yep, Frank Zappa, man, and Duke could hang in that crowd easily, man.
Yes.
He's just one of my favorite all time board players. And then what can you say about that boy? But yeah, the synthesizers have come a long way, because there was a guy, he was my TA. I had a guy named Dr. Ashford, trying to think of his first name, at UCLA teaching electronic music. And there was a little guy in there with our TA by the name of Jim Cooper, who ended up making all of those wonderful electronic gizmos in the mid-80s, the Cooper box and all these synchronizing kind of things. And now Jim Cooper is tucked away somewhere on a rock in an island that he doesn't have to move. Probably bought the island.
Wow.
But yeah, he invented a lot of stuff. Just like we're working a lot with Earth, Wind, George Massenburg was inventing
those vintage tubes.
Wait a minute. Before that, he made a compressor limiter that my wife is one of the emotions. Wow. And she is the one that sings Best of My Love.
Oh, yeah.
She sings so hard on the mic that if the mic and your gear is not up to par, she'll tear up your little stuff.
Wow.
Dry your mic. But she got that pure, pure vocal. And Massenburg invented one of his limiters by doing her, and he was still coming there with the alligator clips on him. Okay, here, let's try this out. And he was inventing every time I seen him. I mean, we were working with him in 1983 or 1984. We just finished merging and stuff, and we were, Wanda and I were producing a track on Todd Bridges. Used to be on Different Strokes.
Sure.
And I'd have Massenburg in there mixing, and then he said, "Why don't you check out the mix?" So when I get through with the list, I said, "Where's George? I want to do this or that." "Oh, he's in the lab." And I would go, "Let me see what George is doing." I'd go down to the lab and say, "Wait, you see this? This fader moves by itself." He was just making his motorized faders.
Wow.
He said, "Each one of these faders costs $5,000. And he had a 30 feet. So I was like right there watching a lot of this stuff go down.
Amazing.
And I'm just looking at my little, I just walked into the music room right now. We were talking, and over at the last studio Maurice had, they had the big Euphonics board. I mean, the real, you know, probably thing cost $300,000+. Plus.
Wow.
Now, Euphonics make these little bitty work desk type, what would be? Mm-hmm. Something like a control surface. I use them with Logic because it's one thing about this computer stuff. Using the mouse, I just can't get any mouse that's comfortable enough when I'm doing a lot of work on the computer. So
right.
This board has helped me so much, even to the point that I've just recorded some live drums and say you want to put a gate on the kick drum to get some of the other noises out. And I had never used a gate in Logic. I got like about 12 gates at my studio.
Right.
We used to do a lot of live stuff, and I go into Logic and I pop up the gate on the Euphonics little master board, and here's all the knobs.
Yeah.
I like turning knobs as opposed to the mouse and moving that, because man, that thing is giving me carpal tunnel.
Yeah.
Bad.
The dog control has really changed your life for me. I have a dog controller also, and like you say, you just want to be able to turn the volume. Sometimes you're trying to, you know, draw a line or just turn the volume down. The mouse will just take it up or down. It doesn't give me that in-between feel comfortably. But when you were on the dog controller, man, you could just turn the knob click by click. So,
yeah. It's been just a saving for me on that. So
yeah, I agree.
You know, but I'm just trying to stay within the realm of old, but with the ideal of the new.
Oh, because you definitely got the combination and equipment, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I have had a great run, and now with this new technology, I love Logic 9, and I think that I can hold me for a while. I've been changing out my speakers and, you know, trying to actually hear in this new room I just put together, but put together those JBLs, the ones that you can pink noise room. And
oh, yeah.
Got a stuff that I'll cut on and off from time to time, but usually just using near fields. I have gone definitely smaller with my speakers because I got the 4430s at the studio.
Wow.
And those are pretty big, but I used to play the music much louder. I notice now I play it softer, and it works so much better when I'm mixing that way. I mean, I still cut it up to hear the, you know,
Right, after it's complete and you're mixed, yeah, you're ready to drive it.
Yeah. It just listening at it at the level of 12 the whole day, I'm like, oh,
yeah, it's
man.
Too hard on your ears, man. You get that ear fatigue real quick. I always mix at low volumes.
Yeah, no, I get ear fatigue quick anyway. But yeah. When I was in my 20s, I didn't know why. I was like, hey, man, I'm sleepy. But, I'm almost finished with this particular project of putting together this desk, and it's between building it or just going with something that's out there on the market already.
Sure.
Believe it or not, just having a perpendicular rack as opposed to one of those that look like it's about a 45-degree angle, that's the difference of me changing a sound or not. Because when you in front of it or on top of it and it's under you, and then you look and say, oh, I want to change this sound. Oh, but I got to get on my knees.
Yeah, that's stressful.
Oh, man, let me tell you, something as simple as that, the older I get, the less patience I have for that. When I was younger, oh, my God, if I got a piece of gear, it would drive me crazy. I had to bust it out of the box immediately, turn it on, at least see the lights and all of that.
Oh, yeah.
The central station is still in the box over here, and all the stuff I got all over the room still in boxes. But that just goes, it just becomes tools. I was telling myself, how many times does a carpenter have to buy a hammer?
Right. Hey, but there's different kind of hammers, though.
See, that's the whole thing. Now my guys come over and says, I just did a bunch of work over here at my house, and these guys come out with these hammers that are on compressors now and stuff.
Sure.
Nail, you know, what they call a nail gun now.
Yeah.
And boy, you talking about this one guy, he built me a wall with just this one thing and a level. And he was gone.
Yeah, take him a couple of minutes versus a couple of hours.
Oh, yeah. I'm talking about one shot. It goes all the way through, three by, like a 2x6. I'm like, damn. So, yeah, I guess so. The technology is changing in every facet that we're in. I just put a printer down here that you can send from anywhere in the house because it goes through the Wi-Fi now. And I was like, oh, that's nice.
Oh, yeah. Well, Wayne, it's been a pleasure for you coming on my show, man. I just love talking with you, man. We got to get together on something, man. We're logic users. We can do some file sharing.
So now, what part of town are you in?
Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Okay. So, do you hang out with some of the boys over there, the Prince boys and all them?
You know, they're not here anymore. Jammin' and moved to L.A.
What?
Yeah, Flight Time West is now in L.A. now.
How about that?
Yep. It's just me now.
You know what? I always had a saying that because we used to go all back to St. Paul and Indiana and all those places. And I'm from L.A., you know, born and raised. And I would look at these beautiful places and I would go, so now, wait a minute. Are you telling me it actually snows right here where we're standing? They go, yeah, man. It snows like, and they show me like up to the waist. Like, I can't believe that.
Oh yeah, it'll get a popping down here or up here.
That winter, I went on the road and I made a new resolution. I said I cannot live anywhere colder than my refrigerator.
Oh, tell me about it, man. It gets cold here.
Man, I mean, I tip my hat to those that can hang because I am. Just a square from Delaware when it comes to that kind of stuff. I can't even imagine a winter. And I just talked to someone right now. They were in Chicago. They were like trying to get back here. So they had to leave Chicago and go to New York instead of coming here because they couldn't get a flight out. And she was like, well, you know, it's with 65 for 2 days and the next day it was 37 and snowing, and you know how it looks in L.A. when it's about to have bad weather? He said the sky was light and snow was just coming down. I'm like,
yeah, it's bad.
Yeah.
Well, but you know, because of technology, man, we could still work together on the email and fly a couple of lives.
Well, let me tell you this. The Spud, that is for sure. I would love to hear some of your stuff as well, man, and definitely hear some of your board playing, because I am getting into the phase now. I'm trying to work smarter, not harder, and I've been really developing a crew of musicians. I mean, keyboardists, guitar, bass, drums, and I have about 3 or 4 different cats for each instrument. Where when I'm producing now, I notice I can do a better job when I'm just sitting there behind the desk and inputting stuff. Because then when I need to do something, I can always overdub what I'm doing. But for what I put this room together over here for right now, it's for live tracking, man. It would be great to hear you do some of that. But I would like to just check you out, period, man, because I know you sound very, very knowledgeable of all the stuff that, you know, is out there right now. And you coming up after the fact, and you still knowing about all these different things. You mentioned a Fairlight. People say, what's that?
I appreciate it, man. Thank you. I'm a fan of music. I'm a student of music, Wayne. You know what I mean? I started early on, and I've been in the game for a while, but, man, I'm still a student. You know, I'm a young Jedi.
Well, that's good, because I would say the real masters are always still the student, you know, because you never know enough. It's always something just like, oh, man, I didn't know that.
Yeah, totally.
And that's what just makes it just beautiful, when you can actually go in and continue to learn and grow. And you keep your mind open like that, things come in, you know. And then as you share with others, you sometimes learn something from your own mouth. You go, wow.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
You know, when you share. So that's the beauty of it. But I appreciate this conversation with you, man.
Oh, it was a blast, man. I had a blast, man. It was a great day for me already.
Well, yeah, y'all on that 3-hour time thing. So
yes.
It's morning here. I was up all night doing some work and kind of crawled in the bed at around 5 this morning. So
wow.
Now it looks good, and I'm going to go and I have a mountain right in front of my house, about a couple of miles down, that I go and hike.
Wow.
About 4 or 5 times a week. And I don't care how many times you do it, when you get to the top, you're breathing like that. So I got to go get a little cardio now and come back here and try to design this table so I can get back to work, man. But
man, we'll definitely keep in touch, though, Wayne.
For sure, for sure. You got the digits. So anytime, man, anytime.
All right, we'll do. Thank you.
Okay, so thanks for calling. And thanks for checking in.
All right, take it easy.
All right, you too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And shout out to Wayne Varm for coming on the show and chopping it up with me, man. And, you know, it's always a pleasure for me speaking with somebody with his experience, man, with all of the artists that he's written for and his experience, man. I mean, this just, the list just goes on and on, you know, just to hear from an industry veteran who's been in the game a while, really knows how to put compositions together, and for him to come on the show and share that with me, his experiences with Earth, Wind & Fire, and his other collaboration was truly an honor for me, man. So I thank you again, Mr. Wayne Varm, for coming on the show. And for my past and current interviews, you can hit my website up at www.spud2tightmusic.ning.com. And I'm also available as a podcast on iTunes. So if you have an iTunes player, go to the iTunes store, click on podcasts, and type in the producer's corner, and click on my image, and you'll have a listing of all my current and past interviews. And for questions and suggestions, hit my email at spud2tight@gmail.com. And again, that's spud2tight@gmail.com. spudtotight.com. And I want to thank everybody for joining in and listening in. And until next time, you guys keep it tight. Peace.